Greetings, everybody. This is Farida. This is the Slow Dive. If you're listening to me on the island of Fiji, overlooking a beach setting, enjoying your, I don't know, whatever beverage of choice, or maybe you're in the garage doing some laundry, or you're just having like an emo soupy weekend at home and listening to my newbie podcast, thank you for joining us. Today we have a really special guest. I'm really happy to bring on someone I look up to, someone who's doing great work in the creative community, the filmmaking community, and that is Jake Yuzna. Welcome, Jake.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. I'm excited to chat with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Whereabouts are you at the moment, Jake?
I'm currently sitting in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is my hometown, and I do a lot of projects here. I've shot quite a bit of my like own independent films and projects in the Twin Cities, so it's kind of nice to, I always seem to be floating in and out. That's where I'm at right now.
Wonderful. Well, how's the weather today?
Sunny. It's sunny and sort of warm. We got snowstorms last week, nearly shut everything down. So I don't know, you know, climate change, you never know. It's a mixed bag. Keeps you on your toes.
Oh my gosh. And I feel like I think we're having a little bit of the Minnesota weather out here because it's kind of rainy out here this weekend. And I mean, I could use the sunlight. So that's one of the things I'm like, I pay too much to live in SoCal to not have sunlight 24/7. It's crazy. Just for our audience to get to know you better, four words you would use to describe yourself.
Guess curious, dogged. Creative, I suppose. And then I'm trying to think of I can't think of a single word for this, but I feel like I'm always up to scheming. Maybe scheming's the last good one.
I love that. That is so honest, scheming. I love it. Okay. Well, wonderful. Four words to describe, in your opinion, the current state of the independent film industry.
Rough. Changing. Potential. I guess I'm trying to see if there's a slightly different one than that. And underground.
Underground.
Yeah. I think independent film is more underground than right now than it's been in a long time. But the perception is that it's everywhere, that anyone can see it. Because we have so many companies who want us to do distribution on their platforms. You know, whether that's Amazon or YouTube or, you know, 1,000 others, it feels like. It's true. You can make your own independent films cheaper than ever before. You can get them out to a larger audience than you used to be able to. But because there's so much, it's more of a tension. This is nothing new. And I feel like if you go to a festival or a lab or, you know, a panel discussion, any of those things, that's what everyone talks about is how do you get eyes? How do you get an audience? How do you do this? That didn't used to be the big conversation. And that kind of rose up because there's so much out there and it's so accessible. So it's actually most people's independent films, you're kind of working in the underground. Mm-hmm. It's just you're trying to get us an audience in the same way kind of underground cinema always did. It's going to be a lot smaller. It's going to be people who are very passionate about that type of work, whether they're looking for something on a topic they love or they're into things that are kind of just slightly different or coming from a different perspective and one that that rings true to them in whatever way that might ring true to them. You know, sort of in the way that a lot of the cinema by and about historically marginalized groups back in the video era or before, it was a big deal to see someone that you could relate to, whether as a queer person or as someone of, you know, Asian descent or a Black American or Chicano or any of these things. Like, there weren't that much films by and about or coming from those communities. So when we saw one, it had this connection. And I feel like now we have, it's different, but there are independent films. They're still really operating sort of under the radar and finding folks that connect to your work. That's probably going to be a smaller audience, but it always has been.
So do you think because we can make more films independently so easily with technology and advancements and all that, but still the visibility because of distribution platforms, there's kind of like a disconnect still. Even though there's more stories out there, there's less mainstream visibility.
Yeah, things kind of, I mean, it at least in sort of my short time on this planet, it seems like when technology shows up, people will tend to have a partial idea of what its impact's going to be. So that could either be the internet really taking off and becoming just part of all of our lives when it started as niche, or I've really sort of like came of age and kind of had my first training when on the cusp of digital production happening. So we were all shooting analog when we were in school, but then we'd finish digitally and we'd have to transfer whether we shot on film or standard definition tape, like a Hi8 tape of some kind, or like Digibeta or something like that. You'd have to transfer it over. So it was, we were all digital post-production and everyone kind of knew that digital distribution was on its way and that the cameras were probably going to only get better and better. You know, once it showed up, there's all these other effects no one thought of. Like, no one thought of, like, great, anyone can make a movie. Oh, that means there's going to be a lot of movies out there. And how do we, like, respond to that? So it becomes sort of a crisis in the kind of business side of things, but also just in the distribution channels, the way we connect with audiences. And I don't necessarily mean crisis is a bad, because crisis just means a turning point. If you go back to its like root actual term, it just means things are changing. It's a point where something cannot be in the way it was and has been changed in something else. And so usually crisis is very unsettling and disruptive because things are shifting and shifting hard and you can't go back. And so I think when there was all these talks exciting about how it would have access to everyone, but which is great in certain ways, but also does create these kind of negative aspects, one of which is I think it's actually hurt craftsmanship in a way. And that was really kind of drilled into me when I was being trained originally. They forced us to shoot on film. They forced us to start with these processes that you couldn't just keep shooting anytime you wanted to hit a button on a camera. And it made you really pay attention to resources, because every time you turn that film camera on, you could just feel, especially as like a broke student or, you know, someone starting out, you could feel your resources going through. So you'd really plan and you'd really think through everything. And you can still do that with, you know, if you're shooting on anything, on an iPhone even, but I don't know if it happened, if you're forced to do it as much.
Right. I think that's a good point. The things I took from that, constraints. When you're dealt constraints, and I guess the older medium of like on 16mm, you have certain set amount of resources. I remember sending off your 16mm to the Kodak labs and then waiting and then splicing them. I mean, yeah, and you're right. With technology, there's greater accessibility, less constraints in that regard to start, but more of a churn and then aesthetic storytelling, POV. Less, I mean, not to sound judgy, but like you have to be very clear on your POV as a storyteller and filmmaker a lot more. And when you're dealing with film, because you don't want to waste it. And then there's this like respect. But yeah, that's very interesting. Tell us about how you started off in film and what your...
Yeah, I guess, I mean, for me, I think it's kind of always been there. I was always very creative, but I was also sort of fortunate. So my mother's a poet. My father is a civil engineer. So he worked for the city of Minneapolis pretty much my whole life. But one of his passions is sort of underground comic books, midnight movies, weird independent. Yeah, like comic books, just weird stuff. I don't think he would all ever consider himself like a researcher. But my father and a few of his siblings kind of are these sort of researchers, where I grew up with like 40 and Times around the house because one of my uncles just signed us up for a subscription. 40 and Times is this British magazine that is, I don't know how many decades old, you know, at least, I think it just turned 50. So it's 50 years old, sort of like Fate magazine. It collects sort of unexplained phenomenon, news of the weird, things like that from around the globe. So I grew up with that kind of floating around. And my dad would take me to like midnight screenings of Jackie Chan, or we had Arkham comics around. And then my mom kind of always introduced me to like museums. And I guess sort of you could sometimes think of it as like fine, you know, high culture, even though growing up between the two, I never had a differentiation. So I was very fortunate to be exposed to a lot of them. And then one of my dad's brothers worked in the film industry for pretty much my entire life. So although I never lived in LA or any of the places internationally that he produced and directed films, I knew it was doable. Or I hear from a lot of folks that they sort of, you know, their families were nervous about them wanting to get into film, or it seemed like it was this impossible thing and it was like a fantasy. It might as well be like a fairy tale to go do it. I knew you could. And so my entire kind of childhood and up through high school, and then finally decided to go to art school for undergrad, I always wanted to make movies and other stuff. So it was like, I wanted to make movies. I wanted to paint. I wanted to make movies. I've gotten to theater. I wanted to make movies. You know, I made music and other stuff. So I was always, or was writing. I was always doing a lot of stuff. Making films was always there. And I kind of just always had the bug. And kind of similarly, I always was really fascinated and obsessed with horror things as early as anyone can remember. Like my first stories are about that I'd make like my parents transcribe when I'd tell them, or I'd draw little pictures for. It were all about like ghosts and graveyards and mummies coming back from the grave. So like, I don't know how many five-year-olds like favorite actor was Claude Rains. If I got near any of it, I was just obsessive. And since my uncle's main part of his career was in horror films, that side of the family was like, oh, we just have another one. Like no one was really like blinked at either. Like no one else is into it. And I don't know, maybe there is just something in the blood, because there's no rhyme or reason why I would have been, or why there's this weird kind of like interest. And then I went to a state run arts high school in Minnesota called the Purpich Center for Arts Education, which is really fantastic. A few states out there, less than I think probably should, have these kind of state run art schools where you apply and you get to go in, and then you get a, you know, your normal high school education, but a vast majority of it's just supporting, sort of a primer for you to go to whatever type of art school you want to go to, whether you want to be a writer or a dancer or a painter or musician or anything in between. That's where I first started doing films with some actual technology that wasn't just like a video camera that we had around. And then similarly, I decided to go to undergrad. I wanted to go to an art school because I was really inspired by actually British musicians of the 70s, like David Bowie and Brian Eno and Brian Ferry and Roxy Music, who are all went to art school. And they went to art school and they took these kind of avant-garde processes and sort of perspectives and then applied them to popular music. And that's what I kind of wanted to do for film. And so I went to an art school for film, had a great time. It was kind of wild. I was fortunate kind of as soon as I graduated to get a few grants. And my undergrad shorts actually got distribution back when you could get some distribution for like short compilations that they would like have kind of niche audiences. So I sold most of my undergrad work for distribution and then got a couple grants and was crazy and was like, I have 10 grand. And there was someone who became a producing partner for many years. And we met because we were interns on Prairie Home Companion, the movie. We had to do all kinds of crazy things like track down a very stoned Woody Harrelson. We got on his bike and disappeared into like the streets of St. Paul and all kinds of weird stuff like that. But I knew Kelly, her name's Kelly Gilpatrick. And we kind of just got along very well on that. And so I got a couple grants and I was like, hey, I've got like 15 grand. Let's make a feature film. And we were too young to know that what we were getting ourselves into. And so we made a first feature called Open. And that we were really lucky, premiered at Berlin Film Festival, and we won a Teddy, and that kind of kicked everything off from there.
Amazing. First feature, so young. I mean, how did that set you up with your understanding of like producing and independent filmmaking going forward? Like, what did you learn from that whole experience?
Oh, we were just making it up as we, I was gonna say we were making up as we go along, but that's not totally true. I think it's kind of healthy not to know any better, because if we knew what we were getting ourselves into, I don't know if anyone had done it, but we were very, I mean, sometimes I worry that this has changed a little bit, but when I was starting out, it was like a band of about 10 of us that were like friends, or the cinematographer, Adam Olson, he was running one of the other film programs at another school in town. And it was just his favorite students, or he thought would be good on a crazy independent project, him, Kelly, and some more friends of ours. And we just, I don't know how we did it. Like we would do 3 to 4 locations shooting on film a day. We would just pick it all up. We were guerrilla, straight up breaking into places half the time, sometimes sneaking in, sometimes we actually had permissions, just figuring it out as we went along. But we'd done enough projects around town that we understood production. We'd done one or two small shorts together. And then Kelly, yeah, she'd already started working for this company called Work, Work, Works, which isn't around anymore. But two producers, they did a lot of American and international kind of independent co-productions, like films by Bellatar and Todd Solondz and folks like that. And so we kind of had a taste of feature production enough that we like knew what we were doing with releases so we wouldn't get in trouble and stuff like that. But other than that, we were just sort of like by hook or by crook, like calling up, you know, and I guess to get back to the thing I was saying about things changing, because it was a small group, but people barely got paid. Me and Kelly didn't get paid. Like we had deferred payments for folks because then we would like shoot it, have to go get extra jobs to pay crew members back for the crappy pittance we said we'd be able to pay them to begin with. There was still this kind of energy in the community and amongst filmmakers that were like, let's just do this. Like, this is not what I'm expecting to have a middle-class life on. Like, I'm not against folks that are like union rules, things, those are great, but like, you know, this is sort of independent filmmakers with a dream cobbling this together. I don't know how that happens without folks kind of just donating their time in that way, realistically, you know, because if everyone has to get paid a middle-class life income, which I totally respect and understand, then only folks from wealth are ever going to be able to make independent films. And to each, it's a personal decision, but you kind of have to decide like what you're comfortable with.
Yes. So you were saying that, you know, making your first feature, indie feature, so fearlessly was like a contribution from friends in the film community. What do you think makes a successful independent film team though? Because I think part of filmmaking community is community, like, and what kind of team do you need to get to the finish line, even if you are in the indie world and working the micro budget, perhaps?
I mean, it's kind of just, you got to be friends. You got to be able to go in kind of the trenches together. I think it's sort of like putting a band together. You know, there's a lot of people who can play the guitar, but do they want to make the kind of music you want to make? Like, does someone want to be a guitarist for Shakira or Ziggy Stardust? You know, it's very, very different. Do you want to be like in Roxy Music or do you want to be the Backstreet Boys? It's a very different interest and background, and neither is right or wrong, but you know, you need that. And then friends, I mean, I feel like sometimes folks are like, oh, well, you know, friends means connection. It means community. It means trust. And that's all true. But I think maybe I come from kind of a slightly older perspective, which is just like, are they cool? Like, are you going to want to hang out with this person? Would you want to be on not a tour bus, in the tour van with these people? And would you get along and would it work out? And then creatively, at least that's where I kind of come from. And then creatively, even on bigger budget things, that's the ideal. You want someone that you're kind of just on the same frequency with, and they get your process and they're open to running with you. Cause I've also run into folks like incredibly talented, great people who seem like they'd be really great collaborators, but very quickly it's like, oh, you want to work like this. That's very different than what I'm doing. And like, if you can't get on the page really fast, it's going to be painful for everyone involved. And I've been on those projects too, and it's awful. But I always think of the best kind of collaborations are these ones where you get each other and you really support each other. Like some of the collaborators I've had on, especially independent stuff, for quite many years now, they'll be one step ahead of me. They'll be like I had production designers who are like, I was like, oh, you took all that stuff on the walls. And they're like, yeah, I knew you would want that. Like before, you didn't even need to walk into this room. I knew that was coming down, you know, or that Kelly, that producer, I would like step up and be like, hey, do you think? And she's like, I've already asked them. I knew you were going to want it. So like that just kind of comes into this second hand you get with folks that you've been working with a long time. And it doesn't mean you don't have a chance to like collaborate with other folks, but I always found it kind of fascinating in independent film that there's this kind of tension that lies in there that you don't see with like people in bands or theater, you know, small theater troupes, where some ego shows up a lot more in film sets. Not to say it doesn't happen in bands, not to say it doesn't happen in theater. I think maybe in some way theater, there's something about the human connection with everyone that's like baked into that process. But in film, sometimes I think we can hide behind the tools and behind the production, the physical production end of it. And the more we get away from that, I think it gets a little you can let the kind of human elements break away. Like, what happened between like theater and film? We're like, this shit would never fly in theater. How did we get to this? And how are we not like collaborating that way and kind of trusting the process and trusting where we can end up? Some of that is maybe just old, it's sort of hangover from the old technology.
I think all of us in independent and in filmmaking in general, we all have one of those stories that we're just like, oh, you're really cool to work with, but I think we have a different vision for this project, or you're very cool, but I don't think we see same frequency, and we're not speaking the same language, so to speak. So yeah, and that is tough, especially if you're working with friends, and that can be uncomfortable. But you know, that's very real. That's very real, because what's the bounce back game from like a bad production? How do you keep pushing forward and making films and movies and projects and deferring pay and paying yourself last and still creating? How do you stay motivated?
There's no other choice. Like for me, I've always had to create and make things. And I think that's also kind of coming from the kind of background of fine art and approaching it. And that, you know, it's like there are certain ideas in a lot of artists that this is ideas, it's more of a calling. Like if you weren't compelled, if you didn't need to, there's no reason to go through all this. You just go get a stable job that paid you well. You know, it's go be an accountant. You have no other choice. There's something that compels you to do it. And for centuries, people have tried to like understand what that is or why. But it's just part of, I think, the human condition for some of us. And there have been times where like, whether it's a hard project or, you know, I walk away with some kind of war wounds from something that I'll be like, oh, I don't know if I want to make movies anymore. And it's usually that, you know, the really old collaborators are like, you will. Like, you just need to like, you need a little space, you need a little distance. But, you know, in the industry, which is very different. And I think when you talked about independent too, I think the lines between independent film and the entertainment industry are sort of clearer than ever before, but also much murkier than ever before in a weird way. And understanding when you are working on a project or making a project, I think understanding for yourself the goal from the outset and reminding yourself of that as sort of like a touchstone can be really helpful, where you're like, oh, I wanted to do this because I wanted to make a short where I really focused on performance, or I wanted to really play with this particular technology, or I wanted to play in this genre, or, you know, I decided to do this because I really wanted to work with this actor. I wanted to build a team and see how well they worked, or, you know, any, whatever that kind of one thing. You said, like, I want to shoot in a different country, whatever. Whatever is that one thing you're trying to do, remembering that that's like the main goal, I think it can be very helpful, because it can kind of help you from letting all these like crazy things bleed into it. Because I've seen plenty of independent filmmakers who want to operate on that independent level with money coming from the industry. And it's like, it's a different world. And I think if you're unclear about what you want out of this and what the expectations are for yourself personally, it's just going to be a world of hurt, because you got plenty of other things stacked against you.
I wanted to ask, you went to AFI. Mm-hmm. And how was that experience for you? And also, do you think, in your opinion, of course, what does the term filmmaker now mean? And do you need to go to school or not to pursue that? Can just your opinions and thoughts.
Sure. Well, I went to AFI because, like I said before, I went to an art school and kind of learned independent filmmaking. It was very much built on, it was sort of like taking the NYU film education model of independent film, kind of this American independent filmmaking model, and then jamming it in an art school is sort of what my undergrad was. So I never like learned traditional story structure. I never learned like traditional directing, like what it really, like the real sort of like carpentry nuts and bolts of what it means to be a director. And so I went to AFI to learn that, because I was like, I can keep making films. And even when I interviewed, they're like, you had a film play in Berlin, why would you come here? And I'm like, because I don't know what a director really means. I've been making this up. And so
it's an imposter syndrome, Jake. Yeah.
A little bit. No, I think for me, it was also just wanting to be better at my work. Because the thing about AFI is it's some ways I think it doesn't get its people understand what it is very well, because, you know, it's well known as one of the LA film schools. There's some famous directors that have come out of it, quite a few actually, but it's actually part of our national film organization. Like AFI is like BFI, like American Film Institute was created by a presidential decree in the Rose Garden, and the school came later, and it was originally created to be basically Jack Valenti, who there's many a story about Jack Valenti, went to the president and said, there's a BFI, those British Film Institutes, like all these European countries have these national film institutes. Why doesn't America? We made Hollywood. We should have one. So they founded the American Film Institute. So the National Film Registry and archive of just about every film made in America with you know, certain definitions exists. And so it has this huge wing. It has a second wing that's kind of runs like the AFI Film Festival and their documentary film festival and a few other things. And then it has a conservatory. And originally they started as giving grants to filmmakers, small grants. And eventually they decided to add a conservatory in the 70s. And the original class was invited by folks who had gotten those grants. So David Lynch and Terrence Malick were just artist independent filmmakers who got a grant, and then they created this new weird school and they asked them if they wanted to come train there. And it was a way of trying to connect young filmmakers from all over the country and now all over the world into Hollywood and LA. But it's really structured like a conservatory school, like if you're going to Juilliard or like a, you know, a music or performing arts conservatory, where you really just go and you focus like you were a violinist. You're not going there to learn how to be the conductor. You're going there to learn how to be the best violinist you can possibly be. So you go and you just hit the ground running and you're basically on union shoots day two, like, and you're making your own union shoots and you are whatever your concentration is there. And for me, it's directing. You are just director. So union rules apply. You don't get to touch a camera. You don't get to edit. You can't pick up anything. It's union rules. You have to, you work with SAG actors and you get to know the film office of LA really well to get permits and do that. You have to do like you're doing local union shoots. So 30 mile rule, labor laws, all that kind of stuff really hits the ground. And you're given a budget for each production by the school and you have to stay within budget. It was hard in a lot of ways. And I think, especially for folks coming from independent film, it can be this sort of like whiplash to suddenly be operating in such a different way. But what was helpful for me is that it really primes you for working in the professional industry if you want to. And at least for directors, it gives a really good understanding of what a director actually does, what your real tools are, and same with story. Like, how do you understand and break down story? And I think for a lot of folks, it helps with sort of like visual storytelling too. But I think because I had so much training in visual arts, I'd already felt pretty comfortable in that arena. And then there's just a lot of collaborations that go south. And it's kind of nice to learn, you know, to burn yourself there and to lick your wounds and do it when it's just like some exercise that no one will probably ever see. And so that's, I think that's helpful. But for me, I really decided to go because I was like, you know, it's hard in most of the world. You're under the shadow of Hollywood. And as any director or filmmaker in America, you're absolutely under the shadow of Hollywood. But for me, although I'd had some dealings with the distribution of my earlier films, I was like, I don't really understand this place. Like, it might as well be this like dark continent on the horizon that I hear legends of, but I don't understand what really goes on in that jungle. And so part of me too was wanting to go and experience it and just sort of begin to get a lay of the land and get an understanding of what this beast is.
Yeah. And it was a great experience for you. Yes.
It was a mixed bag, but I'm glad I did it. I don't regret it.
Absolutely. Jake, how do you define filmmaker? Who is a filmmaker? Who's a director?
This was a very early lesson I received. And it was long before AFI, but it was kind of shortly after my first film came out. It played in LA. The festival was really nice and helped it get like the kind of cover photo of the LA Times Sunday section. So my first feature was called Open, and it played Outfest that year. And the festival had like me and like maybe two or three other filmmakers that they kind of, I think they were called like In Focus or Foreign Focus, something like that. They kind of like decided, hey, let's, and maybe they still do this. It was kind of a way to try to get some attention to some of the filmmakers that year. And so the LA Times did this big Sunday kind of cover culture section on the new queer cinema. And the four of us were the ones kind of highlighted, and which was really nice and really lovely. And it ended up getting me a lot of meetings with a lot of folks. And there was this wonderful manager who said, first thing, had a meeting with them over coffee. And they said, are you a filmmaker or a director? And they're like, there's nothing right. There's nothing wrong. But in this town, they mean two very different things where, you know, a filmmaker in Italy, and I'm paraphrasing kind of from my own spin on it, is someone that we think of as like an independent filmmaker. They're there from the ideation or very into the ideation until the very end for years after still having this film, getting new distribution deals and what have you. But they're there from the ideation, usually the writing in some capacity, you know, pre-production, production, post-production. They are the director. They are the producer, co-producer, probably often the editor. They're the whole kit and caboodle. Where a director really is someone that's brought on to just direct. Your only job is directing. And so, you know, in the industry, that is more common. And even sometimes in like theater, that can be more common. Like, we see you as someone who, let's just say, like, you have comedy background, you know, you are from Tijuana, and we have this film that's about high school kids from Tijuana sneaking across the border to go to prom somewhere. You know, and they'll be like, so we think, you know, you have a great experience being a comedy director. We've seen stuff that's the right vibe, and you have enough of this lived experience that we really think you're the right one for this job. We are hiring you just to direct. And that's a very different expectation. And I think if you walk onto, you know, union industry set thinking you're going to be the filmmaker, you're not going to laugh, you know. And also depending if you're hired to be a feature director, or if you're a television director, and if so, what type of television director? Are you a journey person director? Are you doing the pilot? Are you doing all of like a limited series? You know, it's, and that manager was basically just saying like, look, I need to understand how you are comfortable operating, what you're cool with, and then we'll take it from there. And then they decide whether or not they want to rep me, part of it. And also just making sure that they understood how much I understood or did not understand the industry, and like whether or not they thought I would be a good fit, because really talented filmmakers aren't always going to be able to operate in the industry in a way that they're going to be happy.
So true. So true. I like that clarity question. Are you a filmmaker or a director? Would you think that then filmmakers are also producers? Because producers that come on projects as well, they kind of take it through the whole pipeline with the vision, a creative vision as well. Or is it just, would you consider producers filmmakers? Are they just producers?
I mean, it depends on the product. It depends what they do, I think. I have found that probably, in at least my experience, the most confusing term. Because I think there's no clear definition for it, is creative producer. I think a lot of people walk into creative producer with a lot of different expectations and perspectives. So often when I'm with projects, or either at the beginning or even partway through, people will be like, oh, they might just throw a term out. And I always stop and go, what do you mean by that? And it's because it's a slippiness of language. And when it's not, I mean, let's be real, a significant amount of people as working directors doesn't actually know what it means to direct. They don't know where the term comes from. They don't know what the actual skills are. They don't understand how it evolved out of theater. Like, there's some pretty clear ideas. And I've seen some people do some wild things and say some wild things. And it can happen with producing too. You know, producing can be very confusing, you know, especially in the kind of buy your way into the producing credit thing doesn't help. And the sort of the video market era of like investors getting EP credits didn't help. But, you know, a good producer, honestly, it's a thankless job. And I really admire folks who are excellent at it and understand it, because I think the best producers I've worked with are the ones that truly have a passion for the creative teams they're working with, and they're there to support them. And to me, that's really, I think, at the root of what a producer does. In an independent world, it's just hard because you don't have the luxury of resources, but no film has enough resources. Like, even Avengers 12, whenever it happens, they will not have enough of budget. They will not have enough time. It's always that way. Like, you know, we tend to be very ambitious. But I think a producer definitely, it's the tradition too of the golden age of Hollywood was that the producers kind of were the filmmakers. Like, I think we forget this. That's the reason that Academy Awards are given to the producing team is it was actually historically producers were as famous as the stars, and directors were not famous. That didn't come till later. That's the reason it was like an Selznick production. You know, for all the issues around D.W. Griffith, which there are many, you know, the reason Griffith was famous wasn't that they were a director, is that they were the producer of these films, and they also wanted to direct. So it's kind of the reverse of now, where it's like, oh, well, the director's famous, and then they also want to produce so they can have a greater hand in the final film. It used to be the opposite. So there is still, and it still happens, especially in the industry, but it doesn't mean it can't happen independent, where a producer comes along and wants to, they're sort of the driving force, and they kind of really are one of the filmmakers of the film. But I think the really solid producers in that understand where to let creative people be creative. I think that's where the tensions and the difficulties come through, is when a producer somewhere deep down in their heart wants to be the director, and then they hire a director. And if the producer has not actually like come to terms with that for themselves, it's going to be brutal for everyone involved.
That is the underscore bold thing. I think I've heard so many stories like that where the producer actually wants to be the director and micromanages the director, and then you have like discord. Or maybe they're not building the teams or managing the expectations right. Yes, that's so true.
And I think the really, and I think sometimes, I mean, I don't want to speak for, I'm sure there's horror stories too, but I think sometimes directors can end up being really good producers because they can empathize with the directors and the other creative people and know to give them their space, because they can empathize with the idea of someone encroaching on them. You know, when you're being creative, even by yourself, it can be an difficult position to have someone look at what you're doing or be in the middle of it, because you're figuring it out and working on instinct in a lot of ways. No matter how big the plan is, there's always some instinct in there. And so if you're, you know, if you're doing that thing, like, you know, let's say you're a musician and you get to be in your studio, you can kind of jam and just be like, everyone needs to stay out while I'm writing, while I'm in the zone. For directors, you're doing that surrounded by people having 1,000 questions, with God only knows who coming onto your set and asking crazy things, or, you know, an executive, and, you know, often they mean well, often they're just bored. I don't know how they're really helping anything. You know, that can be micromanaging in that same way, where it's like, you want to be creative, but that's not your job. Can you let the creative be the creative? Well, you don't see it in theater in that way. Like, that's where I turn to like theater and bands as a good example, is you can see there's a real respect for each person's role creatively in that process. And, you know, I think for producers, it can be a little bit trickier. But to be honest, I've seen cinematographers too, where I'm just like, yo, DP, you are not the director. Can you just back off? Like, go get hired as a director then. Have at it. Shine on. But like, that's not what we signed up for this project. So can you please stop pretending? And that's where I say, like, for folks, like, a lot of the problems these days, which I think has changed some, at least in my experience, is people not being honest with themselves, with what they want. I see that causing more problems these days. In an independent film, like, I've done projects somewhat recently where, you know, it's still, we're not paying anything like that is a professional rate. Like, this is just like a little indie dream and some craziness. But what I always do, and for my own sort of approach, is I'm absolutely transparent from it. It's like, this is what we can offer. This is what it's going to entail. These are the hours. These are the weird things. If you don't want to take it, don't come on. Like, that's fine. No harm, no foul. But if you do, and then you start complaining about that stuff partway through, then I have a little bit more of a tricky with it, because it's like, hey, we were transparent about what this was. And we understand that, or at least I can understand that, like, you say, fine, 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 then in the middle of it, it feels very differently. But like, you entered into this. So, you know, there becomes this sort of like a cord and this trust that happens when you decide to, you know, jump off a cliff with someone.
Going back, you made some really important points. And I think transparency, clarity, know what you want, what your expectations are out of a project, and be very clear with yourself. Would you also say, Jake, that the team has to be equally invested in seeing the project finish and follow through? Because everyone gets something out of it, especially when you're working with smaller budgets, unless you're starting out in the beginning and you're learning as you go. I feel, at least, and I'd love to know your thoughts, like, everyone has to have the same amount of energy and investment to see through the project. Because that's something, because you run out of steam when you run out of money.
Yeah, I think for me, it's maybe not everyone on the same energy or investment level. I think it's, you want everyone to really care about their work and their craft. Because, you know, let's be real, the actor, once they are done, they're not going to give a shit about post-production. you know, like they're, you know, maybe they'll have some worry about what they look like, depending on how comfortable they are seeing themselves. But otherwise, their job's done. Same, like, you know, the person that's recording, your sound recordist, when you're done, they're done. But during that thing, they're contributing to the project. If they're a nerd about what they do, that makes me happy. That means they care, they're knowledgeable, but it's coming from a place of passion. It's coming from a place of care. And it's a little, like, I like to say craftsman because it kind of like knocks down some of the ego around it. Because although I think craftsmen should be recognized a lot more than they are in this country, it does have this sort of like less of like feeding of the ego. But it's like, yeah, if you really love to do this thing and you would have the same amount of passion if you were a plumber or if you were my like DP. Like, that's what I'm looking for. Like, someone who's just going to nerd out, who's going to tell me the, like, weird technical things about how this, like, one piece of the chip on the red camera works. Like, I love that. Someone who's really into, like, talking about lighting or even, like, having a PA on a larger budget thing, like, talk my ear off about, like, I don't know, some new script supervising software they found and how they think they might have found a passion for being a scripty. And I'm like, that's wonderful. Let the craft feed you and be the place for you to put in that creativity in that place, because then it's all going to ladder up to something that's really fantastic. And that doesn't matter if you have like $8 or $8 million.
Very true. Yeah. Passionate about what you're working on, your craft. I think that's definitely a very good point that you made. And I think that is from successful projects. Yes, you see that people really love what they're doing and it shows in the final product. Yes. Thank you. Well, we're going to go to our final segment, Jake, about the Film North Inclusive and Socially Conscious Filmmaking Lab, which is supported in part by the National Endowment of the Arts, approaching its fourth year. I love this lab, so I'm just going to first gush about it. I love the lab and its impact and all the great work you're doing, but you are the founder of the lab. You came up with this amazing lab. How did you start it? When did you start it? Why? Tell us about the lab.
Sure. It was founded in 2020. So it was high the pandemic. Big influence was the protests after the murder of George Floyd. And being from the Twin Cities. And so I should also say, so Film North is the upper Midwest's kind of largest independent film not-for-profit. As an organization, they started as Film in the Cities, which was in the 70s at some point. I don't remember the name. That was kind of the first group, like kind of cinema, cinephile, filmmaker cooperative in the Twin Cities. So it was the first place you could get gear. It started in the Minneapolis St. Paul Film Festival, split off of it, like all these kind of other organizations split off of it. And then it eventually was IFP Minnesota, when IFP used to be a national network of independent film not-for-profits in the 90s, and then turned into Film North. They were the first place to ever like hire me when I was an undergrad to be like a teacher. I found them off like a Craigslist ad. I think it was like 18 and they hired me. So like, and they give grants, they do all kinds of really wonderful things. They helped advise on my first feature. I think they were a fiscal sponsor of it, maybe even. I've kind of been involved with them off and on for years. And after all that stuff was kind of going on, I was like, you know, everyone's stuck at home. It's the middle of a pandemic. They'd asked me during the pandemic to do some online teaching for them, which was a lot of fun because I started to teach like horror, sci-fi, and fantasy screenwriting and some like other classes like that. And I was like, you know, I was noticing something that had shifted in the kind of landscape of the Twin Cities after I'd left, because although I more or less grew up here and went to undergrad, I left for about 10, 15 years. And then I'd come back to do projects, but I was based in like New York or Europe or LA or other places. And I'd noticed kind of the makeup of folks in not-for-profits had shifted. When I was coming up, it was very diverse who was in charge and who was, and very open. And not to say that the kind of new guard wasn't open, but I'd noticed folks started to really kind of look the same. And we'd been having all these conversations about, you know, sort of after Me Too and Oscar So White of like, what do we do about this? And my kind of thought was, you know, we're all so busy because of just all kinds of crazy things, like just being independent filmmakers, it's you're going to be busy anyway. And just the weird sort of idea of gig economy churn forever we live in. I was like, you know, I think one of the bigger issues is we talk about wanting all these changes to happen. And the kind of changes that I've seen in my lifetime all came sort of grassroots. It was people as individuals. You know, like when I first came out, working on professional sets was so racist and homophobic and sexist. It was like comparative today, wild what was just allowed. like just really rough, to the point where I kind of moved away from working on film sets and stuff because I was just like, I'm sick of dealing with this. It's not worth it. You know, this isn't an environment that's helpful. So I started working in the arts more because I was like, there's people here who like won't, you know, like I feel comfortable. I feel comfortable being myself. I don't have to worry about it. And luckily that's changed some, but I was like, you know, the times I did feel comfortable in those spaces was individuals, one-on-one, making space, connecting, you know, whether they were queer people like me or just other folks who saw it, you know, whether they came from historically marginalized communities or were just nice people. And we're like, oh, this, I can tell this person's like, this isn't a comfortable environment. Let me do something about it. Even, you know, getting them a cup of coffee from Crafty, you know, just like these small things and gestures. And having gone through places I worked, also like at AFI, a lot of these kind of DAI things, I was like, the kind of programs. So like, you know, I think if we as independent filmmakers want to help make change happen, it's about knowledge sharing. It's about skill sharing. It's about just connecting. And it's about carving out a time to do that. And to do these kind of moments of like individual, how do I want to tackle these big themes? Because also after all this stuff and post George Floyd, there were so many DAI programs and so many like these terms were being thrown around like nobody's business, but they were all at sort of a corporate level or a large level. Even not-for-profit, it had to be a pretty large not-for-profit. And so I just kind of went to Riley Tillman, the head of education at Film North, and Andrew Peterson, the exec director, and said, hey, I have this idea. Would you be open to us doing a lab? Free, open to anyone in the world. It would be about independent filmmakers coming together to knowledge share and think about what does inclusive and socially conscious practices mean to them. And the goal being not that we're going to have everyone walk out with this like stamped certification that they feel like they've stamped it and they've done, which, you know, there's a lot of critique around that with DAI programs, but actually being like, how do you as an individual filmmaker want to make a tool to have something change? And that could be in the subjects of the films you're making, but also in the process in which you're making it. Process is really big for me. I think that's probably partially coming out of an arts training. And so they were down and they said, sure. And they ponied up the first little chunk of money to do it. And this wonderful screenwriter, Crystal Javier, joined to kind of co-found it, lead it with me, because I didn't want to be the only voice doing it. Working with Crystal, we really talked about, you know, we're not the instructors, we're the facilitators. We're here just to get this group together. And it was, I think the first year was 12 or 14. We always try to kind of keep it around 10 or 12. And we would meet for 6 weeks, 6 or 8 weeks, once a week, and kind of talk through these ideas of like, well, what would a tool be for it? What would, and that could be a process, that could be a knowledge sharing, you know, like document, that could be all kinds of things. And then also the second half of every class is we'd have a panel of folks from the field, filmmakers, executives, producers, festival folks, people from funders or other not-for-profits. And it would just be unrecorded, honest roundtable group chat about like, let's talk about this. What does this actually mean? And there were some real serious conversations, some real honest conversations. And we also, when we were, you know, selecting the group too, saying like, you know, what often happens, and me and Crystal would make jokes about this, but it's like, whenever you end up in those rooms of DAI people, it's like all the people from the historic marginalized groups. And we'd all look at each other and be like, I don't really know if we need to hear this because we know about it. We know it really well. It seems like there's other folks, colleagues, whomever, who maybe should be in this room too. And so we would think about it too. And we'd say, you know, it should be open to everyone and show a real reflection of the diversity of filmmakers and voices. But that doesn't mean like straight white people shouldn't be in there too, because actually like for some of them, it might be the most helpful. Or it's just a way that you can begin to like build those connections to one person's like, hey, we're working on this like ethics project around whether AI or otherwise, like generative stuff in documentaries. You guys might not know about it. Here is the Google Drive link. Here's this grant. Here's this. And so we've been really fortunate. NEA in the second year stepped in to help fund us. And so it's kind of every fall we still do it. It's 10 to 12 people from all over the country or world. We define filmmaker to kind of a point you made earlier very loosely. So you could be a PA. You could be a filmmaker. You could be a director. You could be a producer. All applies. And we try to make sure that we have a real kind of robust diversity, not only in like lived experience, but experience in their career and coming from different backgrounds. Some people want to make children's programming. Some people want to make documentaries. Some people want to make a Marvel movie. Some people want to make an independent horror movie. And then folks from all over the country. And each year we at least have like 2 to 4 people from somewhere else in the world, which blows my mind because they're staying up to like 4 a.m. in like places to like join us and be part of it. So yeah, it's been great.
I like how you created like a safe space for discussion. And I think the important part and the impact of this lab is, yes, definitely underrepresented communities. We all know, you know, if you're Muslim, if you're a woman of color, if you're queer, any of those communities underrepresented, they know what it's like to work within the systems, but like it's the allyship, right? For people to have safe spaces to know like, hey, how do I ask my Muslim friend about this? How do I ask my Black friend about this? Or am I out of line with this without being canceled? And really having that safe space to discuss those topics. And I think what you do really well in your lab is building out those, I think, thinking process too, how to implement those frameworks. It's a great lab. And what do you plan on doing with it in the future?
You know, we're hoping to keep it trucking at Film North, but then also the folks that are working on it, we've also begun to kind of talk about, well, how can we maybe consider expanding this and opening it outside the lab, creating sort of a framework so we can work with film productions, individuals, companies, places to bring this in and say, you know, like, look, like the, what is it, Green Sets, which is like a great, you know, initiative to try to make the film industry less wasteful, or like, you know, the No Animals Were Harmed stamp at the end of a film. Like, those are important and they're great, they're there. But for these kind of processes, the last thing you want is just like a stamp to be like, okay, we're not racist, stamp. And you're like, that's rough. But, you know, like the knee-jerk reaction in, for all kinds of factors, you know, a lot of big organizations and corporations, they kind of end up just knee-jerk reacting, where like the real lasting change comes from an individual, and it comes from us slowing down, us taking the space and the time to reflect and to think. And when you make that pause and have that time, then when you go back into it, even in these small ways in the back of your brain, it starts to shift things. So I always like to say in the lab, like, you know, this isn't, you're not going to walk out and be like, I solved bigotry. You're going to come out hopefully with these seeds planted and the beginning of building sort of muscles or tools that can then serve each individual who's come through the lab, hopefully for the rest of their lives, but at least for a while. And you know, I always like to say tools, and sometimes, and you've seen this further too, like people get a little confused. They're like, is this a tool? Is this a this a this? And it's like, the answer is yes, it can all be, you know, but it should be an evolving process too, because no project's ever going to be the same. Even if it's the same group of people who worked with 1,000 times, every moment it is this grouping of people at this time in their lives, in this place, doing this project at this moment. If you started a month later, it would be a whole different story. And so having that kind of more of like tools or frameworks or methods, then you can build into your process. Okay, here's where we stop and we talk through stuff. Here's how I think about, is the physical production I'm doing going to be accessible to persons with physical disabilities? Is it going to be comfortable? Are people going to feel okay just being themselves? Can we not censor the projects we're doing by doing this other framework around it? I think in a way, and I'm just sort of realizing this now as I say it out loud and we talk about it, is when I went through AFI, I think some of that also kind of inspired the way I wanted to approach the lab, because I was fascinated by having to work in the traditional, you know, union style, all this stuff, but it was all based on shooting on 35mm cameras. And then I turn around to the independent film world and I'm like, why are you all acting like you're a Hollywood production? Like, why is everyone like, we need this and we need trucks and we need this? I'm like, that's so much money. Like, you have a Red or you have an Alexa, like that you managed to get. You could film this with a candle and it would still look great. Why are we acting like we still need to light this like 35mm film? That's crazy. Or I think of like Dogma 95, where it's like, I remember, you know, back in the 90s, although, you know, I think I was still only like middle school, high school, you would see people be like, okay, we're going to take this like 3-chip video camera and try to shoot like a film on 35. And you're like, that's going to look awful. But then you saw things like Dogma or Blair Witch or things that took advantage of like, this is what the medium looks like. We're going to lean in. And so for me, the idea of like process in filmmaking right now, and I do think there's a crisis in it a little bit, where there are certain things that are really holding on to these old ways of working. And then there's folks that are being incredibly progressive with the technology. And I don't actually think it's like the dichotomy is as much as like studio films and independent films. I think it's happening in both places. And so this idea of like rethinking the process. And I think when it comes to this idea of like a crisis of independent film, it's a crisis because we're rethinking all these processes. We have the opportunity and then we're also being forced because of different things. And so, you know, distributions are rethinking the process, but even the way we collaborate together, the way we do physical production. And for me, the lab is about injecting inclusive and socially conscious practices into these rethinking of the processes.
Yeah, it's definitely a mindfulness practice in all stages from pre to post to distribution. And I do like what you said. We in the independent world right now, with we don't know what direction we're going in because everything is shifting because of the streamers and technology. And now with this whole looming AI Sora on the horizon, I do feel like it's up to us to make those creative choices and prioritize what that is. And I think it goes back to just being intentional, like what we want out of film, how we define ourselves. Are we filmmakers, producers, or directors? Why are we doing this in the first place? Who are audiences and what the message and the impact is? And I think that kind of sums it up. But I could probably go into hour number two with you and talk about horror. If this was a good experience, invite you back. I want to get into horror because I know that's the world that I kind of started off in and you're into that as well. And there's some lessons there we all can take from. But thank you for the lab. I really wish it a lot of success going forward. I think these are things that in the film community are impactful and continue to create safe spaces for us to be more mindful, intentional filmmakers and producers. Going forward, what is next for you? What kind of projects are you working on? What do you want to do more of?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a few different things. So there's like the lab, which is kind of its own creature that, you know, I'm working with some wonderful folks to think about what additional life it can have. And then I'm still sort of in post-production on a film, a genre film that's sort of inspired by soul plurality, which is this religions kind of that go way back all over the globe, definitely in like Central South America, in Asia, or I should say Southeast Asia, but definitely also in like certain indigenous groups in North America and in Europe as well. There is an idea that each individual has more than one soul. You know, that kind of like Christian, or I should say Judeo-Christian idea of one soul. And so I was kind of really inspired by that. And there's this idea that like when something, when you become ill, or if you have mental health, what we now consider mental health issues, that it was one of your souls was misaligned or sick. There's something wrong in the balance of who you were. And so some groups, you know, considered you like a soul of the animal world, a soul of the earth, a soul of the heavens, a soul of humans, and that they're all together. So I was really kind of inspired by that. And then a community of folks that really came out of the 70s called Walk-ins, which are people who believe that their soul, the soul that was born into their body has left and another soul has come in. So it tends to happen to folks after moments of trauma or experiences of trauma. I interviewed a lot of walk-ins and, you know, they'd say it was kind of like this very calm moment where they knew someone else was now in their body. They were in a different soul in their body. So we shot this film, parts of it during kind of the height of the pandemic in the Twin Cities. And we're very slowly poking away on post-production. And then I'm way behind on a new draft of another feature that's going to take place in genre world and has to kind of do with architecture and the occult. So has to do with city architecture and the occult.
I love that. Okay, so the Soul Polarity film, you're in post-production. Is that a narrative fiction or a documentary? Mm-hmm.
No, it's narrative fiction. Originally, when it was a very process-based film too. I was fortunate. I tend to be lucky to have certain projects that are grant funded, so they let me just go totally wild. And then projects that have like more traditional investment where I have to like make a more normal movie or they get freaked out. So often the grant projects are kind of like the more sort of experiment. They're not experimental film by any means, but they allow me to play with process in a way that, you know, you see more happening in like European directors or places where they have governmental funding that allows a little bit more creativity to seep in than, you know, a market-driven investment would. When I first started, I thought I was going to be making a film about walk-ins. And then as the project kept coming together, I was like, you know, this is kind of deviating enough from walk-ins and I don't want to misrepresent these folks and, you know, their very earnest beliefs and community. And so I kind of knew about soul plurality and I was like, I actually think this is kind of maybe more where it's coming from. So that was kind of one of those things you just discover during the process of filming and making it too.
Fascinating. Well, I would love to have you back to after that film is finished and where it's going and learn more about it. Thank you, Jake. I know this conversation, I always learned so much. Thank you for sharing all these great insights and wisdom from your film career and with the lab, with our audience today. I really appreciate you coming on to my podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Where can people find you if they want to? Do you have a website?
I have a website. That's probably the best place to go, but it's just jakehuesner.com. It's pretty simple.
Great. Well, everybody, follow Jake's film career and his amazing projects that are coming up down the pipeline. And once again, thank you. This is a Slow Dive. I am Farida. Let's make an impact one episode at a time.